So I get these calendars for Christmas. They're like the little rip off per day, different thing every day.
Yeah, you had the dad joke of the day last year.
That was last year, yeah. So this year it's mental floss, amazing facts. So it's just like a crazy fact every day. But yes, and I threw it out and I was so upset because I wanted to tell you about it and I chucked it. But it was something to the effect of that Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad was a suspect in a real life murder investigation.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Didn't know so that. He and his brother had taken like a motorcycle road trip across the country. And during their trip, they worked at this restaurant where the head chef was like a horrible person. And apparently the chef died. So I had to like dig into this. And I looked it up and it said, actor Bryan Cranston said he was a murder suspect in real life. The Breaking Bad actor made the revelation on The Tonight Show. Apparently, the head chef was a guy named Peter Wong. And this is a quote from Cranston. Now, Peter Wong was a good chef, but a horrible person. He was the first person I ever met who I just realized, oh, my God, I hate this guy. I don't think I ever hated someone before Peter Wong. But then like a week later, the guy's murdered. And so police start questioning. I know, right? So they start questioning the waiters and stuff. And the employees are like, yeah, these two brothers really hated this cook. So all of a sudden, Cranston's like this. And he's like, yeah, we hated him, but I didn't kill him.
Oh, my God. Did they ever find out who did?
I don't know. I didn't get that far, but interesting.
Wow.
More importantly, today's fact of the day. The average human produces anywhere from 0.5 liter to 1.5 liters of saliva daily.
Ew. Oh.
The more you know.
The more you know.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode number 60 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, longtime true crime producer Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, the Sassassin, Melissa Spivey.
I like that one. I don't think I could say it. Sassassin.
Sassassin.
But I like it.
Sasquatch. This is my
co-host. That one too.
Sasquatch. Oh, man, Melissa. Well, we are diving into week 3 of our July block called Girl Power. And we have definitely seen some amazing women do some amazing things. In week 1, we just learned about how your badass idol, Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick, really is after she helped solve the Phoenix Canal killings. And then last week, you took us across the pond and introduced us to another pretty incredible scientist, Patricia Wilshire, whose work analyzing some nettles helped bring down the king of perverts, Ian Huntley, for the deaths of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. What an awful story.
Yeah, that case was heartbreaking, but Patricia was amazing. It was so cool to read about her. And I've actually come across a couple other cases that maybe we'll cover that she helped with one day.
Super cool. I think we could get her on, too. Her and Colleen, I think, would welcome the chance to come on a podcast.
Oh, I would love it.
Totally. So today's case, it's going to be a little different because we're going to be talking about not one, not two, but 3 badass women, one of which helped solve a crime with her heroic actions. Mm-hmm. And all 3 of these women I'm going to be discussing today are survivors. And what they survived is nothing short of miraculous. And it seems like a good spot to tell you all that we're going to be deviating just a little bit from the structure that we promised you last week. So a couple hurdles happened behind the scenes that we're overcoming, but mainly because the story is so massive that in order to do it justice, we didn't want to just cram everything into an hour just for the sake of doing so. So that being said, this week will be part 1. Next week will be part 2 of this story. And then we're going to end the month with an incredible guest that you will not want to miss. And with that said, Melissa, is there any housekeeping that we need to address before we kind of get into it?
Just the usual. If you are enjoying this, give us a like, subscribe, comment. You can hit us up on our socials at Murder Unscripted, email murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or our website, murderunscriptedpod.com.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to start off today by doing something that I don't normally do because this is a show about murder, after all. So it should be pretty self-explanatory that you're going to hear some pretty awful things. But this story, I feel like, does require kind of a blanket trigger warning. We're going to get into some heavy shit today. Mm-hmm. And it is not for the faint of heart.
No.
And you all know that we do not sugarcoat things here because we refuse to cover up facts and the reality of these horrific crimes. So if you're not okay hearing about kidnapping, about real instances of sexual, physical, and psychological torture, then I definitely recommend skipping this episode, maybe even next week's. And God, that pains me to say that because we never want you to skip what we're put time and effort into doing here, but we totally get it if you have to.
Yeah, I mean, you got to take care of yourself first. Your mental health is priority number one.
Facts.
I also need to add to that trigger warning a huge animal cruelty trigger warning. You all know how I feel about dogs, and this case, especially that part, totally like broke my heart. So, warning. We will go through it quickly, but still.
We will, and that really won't come into play until next week, now that we broke this into two parts, so we'll remind you again next week, but yeah, it's be warned. So with that out of the way, this is a tale that embodies courage, it embodies resilience, and fight. And in my opinion, this right here is the true essence of girl power. And we're about to hear a story of a house that stood at 2207 Seymour Avenue in Cleveland. And many of you true crimers will probably, the second I say that address, may know exactly what we're talking about. What happened inside that house isn't just a true crime tale. It's a raw, unfiltered look at what it took to survive an unassuming monster and a case that shook not just Cleveland, but the world.
Yeah, since we decided to cover this case, I have to say I was dreading it a little bit. Survivor stories are, of course, incredible, but when you're hearing what happened from the person it actually happened to, it's harder than just reading about what they think may have happened to a victim. And as some of you may remember from Laura Cowan's case, I couldn't even make it through the watered-down Lifetime movie version,
right.
Let alone the real, true, unfiltered story. That being said, in preparation for this episode, I did read a book written by one of the survivors, Michelle Knight, and it is called Finding Me. And I will be honest, I had to skip some parts because it was so soul-crushing. So this is going to be a journey for all of us. That being said, because we used Michelle's book as our primary source, this episode will be mostly her experience, especially this first episode. And she was held captive the longest. And I believe that she bore the brunt of this monster's abuse, torment, and torture.
I agree with that. And you were talking about survivor stories. That's the hard part, is you know there's going to be a happy ending because they're called survivor stories for a reason.
Yes.
But all of the things that lead up to them surviving, it's horrific. Well, let's dive into this. So we start out on a quiet suburban street with postage stamp sized lawns in the Tremont neighborhood of Cleveland, Ohio, in August of 2002. Beneath the noise of the summer block parties and neighborhood barbecues, something sinister was brewing on Seymour Avenue. Something so dark and so unimaginable that the city itself would live in denial for over a decade. Between 2002 and 2004, three young women would vanish without a trace. The first was Michelle Knight. She was a kind of a down-on-her-luck local girl who was trying to get her life back on track at the time. And her disappearance didn't spark national headlines. There were no Amber Alerts. There was no primetime media coverage, no candlelight vigils. She was literally just forgotten. So this seems like a great spot to drop into our story. So Michelle Knight was born on April 23rd, 1981. Her mom's name was Barbara, and I'm not entirely sure about her father's name. So I saw it listed as Bart. I don't know if you saw anything different, but I can't confirm that.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything.
Well, regardless, Michelle has two brothers who were twins. She calls them Freddie and Eddie, and they were 2 years younger than her. And as a child, Michelle had dreams of becoming a veterinarian or a firefighter. And what I love about this is that Michelle only grew up to be 4'7". So she had no intention of letting her small stature like get in the way of her big dreams.
I love that little body, big personality, just picturing this little like Spitfire climbing up a ladder, fighting fires.
Right. How great that she like, doesn't matter. I'm going to do what I want to do.
Yep. Good for her.
Well, for that little bit of backstory that I just gave you, that's pretty much where the positive memories end. So while Michelle did enjoy living in Cleveland, she did not enjoy living in her own home. So her life prior to the abduction was marked by a relentless struggle for survival. At one point, her family lived in a station wagon for almost a full year. She was raised in an environment filled with physical abuse, instability, chronic poverty. Even when they were living in a home, not just a car, the family didn't have a couch to sit on. Like, they didn't have a stove. And Michelle told ABC News one time, quote, "Just to give us a hot, warm meal, I had to cook on a space heater. It took 4 hours to cook a hot dog." End quote. And other family members would often stay in the family's home, and there would sometimes be up to 15 people in this teeny tiny house. So, as Michelle writes in her book, it was obviously very chaotic. And this part is equally sad to me, because Michelle mentions that her mother liked to say, children should be seen and not heard.
Why do people have kids if that's how they feel?
I agree. Well, Michelle found herself forced into the role of caregiver for her younger siblings and multiple cousins because she was thrust into this very adult role while still being a child herself, which, in my opinion, helped save her later in life, which we're going to get into shortly. But I do really believe that her awful upbringing is the only reason she's alive today. And that this is all going to make sense once the story comes together.
Agreed.
So Michelle's family often ran out of soap. They ran out of toothpaste. And Michelle tried her best to get her brothers and cousins cleaned up and ready for school with like providing some basic necessities for hygiene. And needless to say, Michelle had kind of little understanding about what safety and support truly meant because she was just trying to keep this whole thing together. So when Michelle was a young child, she was about 5 years old when a male relative began sexually abusing her. And eventually this abuse would become daily. And it would go on for the next 10 years. And the relative threatened to kill her if she told anybody. So Michelle was obviously forced to keep this awful secret to herself. And we aren't sure who this male relative was. In her book, she just referred to him as an older male relative. So we don't want to speculate, but Michelle struggled in school as she was the target of school bullies. I mean, she and her siblings often went to school dirty. We just talked about the struggles that they had. So obviously they had stained clothing. They probably didn't smell the best. So really think about this situation. This poor girl is being abused at home and then just relentlessly bullied at school. So how do you find any joy in life whatsoever? Mm-mm. And things were so bad that at 15, she throws a couple basic necessities into her book bag and runs away. She kind of figured it would be safer living on the streets than in this house. Like, how freaking sad is that?
It was really tough reading about her childhood. She talked about how she never knew where she was going to sleep at night. She didn't have a room or even like a bed to call her own. Mm-hmm. And she also wrote about how kids at school were so, so horrible to her. They would torment her for being dumb or for smelling bad. And at one point in the book, she talks about how she went to introduce herself to like another student, a little girl. And as soon as she said, "Hi, I'm Michelle," the little girl loudly yelled, "Ew, your breath stinks."
Oh, God.
In front of everyone. And the kids would look at her and then hold their noses when the teacher turned their back. Like, that's kids awful. Are assholes.
They are assholes.
But it's wild that she was 15 and thought that it would be better to live on the streets. Like, Ed, your daughter's 14. Can you even imagine her having to make that decision to move out? I can't fathom how dire a situation must be to choose living on the streets.
Yeah. And I can't, to short answer, because my daughter did go through some bullying, and just to listen to her come home and see her so upset about the things she endured at school. And she's a normal kid, you know, like I cannot imagine what it would have been like for Michelle, but to think about my own daughter, the things getting so bad that she would have to live on the streets. It's not even something that even has ever crossed my mind until you just brought that up. So thank you for that.
Oh, sorry. You're welcome.
Well, Michelle obviously tried her best to make it on the street. She ran away, I think it was like mid-November, which obviously quite cold in Cleveland. She found a spot underneath a bridge, but it was like a highway overpass, and set up a little kind of makeshift camp. She lived in a literal garbage bin and stole a blanket off somebody's porch just to stay warm. And she would say that passing cars overhead were kind of therapeutic. She would listen to these cars like you and I would turn on our Alexa and put white noise on, just something to drown out daily life. So while she was living under this bridge, a man from the local Baptist church approaches her and invites her in for a hot meal. And apparently they'd served like free dinner every night at 5 o'clock. And this man also gave Michelle a coat and had donated some clothing and some toiletries to help like get her back on her feet a little bit. So she would air quotes bathe in the church restrooms. That was kind of her way of staying clean.
Yeah.
And she eventually started to go to these nightly dinners, but also the weekly church services as well. It was like a safe space for her. She loved the choir music. I read something about her singing these hymns, and it was just a way to, like, again, forget about everything for a second and just be.
Yeah. And I think that was the first place she went where people were kind to her and they weren't judgmental and they offered help without strings attached.
Right. And what sucks is you're going to find out that this is also what drives her back into this awful situation. So after a few months of living under this bridge, she's approached by a young man and he introduces himself as Sniper. And we don't really have time to go into the full story, but essentially Sniper was this young drug dealer and he brought Michelle in to be a runner. And Sniper, Michelle, and another teenager named Roderick, who was also a runner, they became this little like family. They kept each other safe. They took care of each other and things were going well for a while. They all lived together. They ate dinner together. It was like this little clique. And yeah. Michelle finally had a bed and a shower and she was making money. However, one day Michelle and Roderick were forced to flee because of their, what they were doing wasn't exactly on the up and up, and returned back to the bridge because Sniper, his place was raided and he was arrested by the police. So while Michelle and Roderick were kind of walking around town one day, a friend of her parents spotted them. And within minutes, Michelle's father shows up. He pulls up in his car and drags her into the car, brings her back home. And Roderick took off and Michelle never saw him again.
I don't understand this part. Like I said earlier, and I might get crap for talking shit on her parents, but they clearly didn't want to be parents. Like, you think they would have said, okay, bye. You know, yeah. Like, leave her out there.
Yeah,
public service announcement. Don't have kids if you don't want to be a loving and supportive parent. Just that's it.
Say it louder for the people in the back. Jeez,
I just don't get it.
Well, Michelle was forced to come back home in late February, where the sexual abuse from this male relative began again. And she was sent back to school. So you can imagine that she endured twice as much ridicule from her peers. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a silver lining, though, because she did start to see somebody. And in the book, she calls him Eric. We know his real name, but we'll call him Eric too. And Eric was kind to Michelle. He was one of the first people that like treated her like a person. And she quickly fell in love with him. And they hadn't been together long when Michelle discovered that she was pregnant. Around this time, she also found out that Eric had a girlfriend, though. And Michelle was just heartbroken, especially when Eric chose to be with his other girl over Michelle. So despite the fact that she didn't have Eric's support, Michelle wanted to be the best mom that she could be for her baby. She wanted to be the mom that her mom was not. Mm-hmm. So Michelle made the decision to drop out of school at the end of her 10th grade year because she knew she needed to support herself and her baby. So she started searching for a job, anything she could find. Unfortunately, because she didn't have a car and because she hadn't finished high school, she obviously had limited options. So baby Joseph, who they called Joey for short, was born on October 24th, 1999. This was about a month before he was due, so he was a little bit of a preemie. Mm-hmm. But he was healthy, he was a beautiful baby, and Michelle was head over heels the second she laid eyes on him. But as we have seen time and time again, this story is about to take a dark turn. So by early summer of 2002, Michelle's parents had split up and her dad was out of the house. Her mother started dating this new guy, and we'll call him Carlos. He moved into the house, and Carlos was a drunk, to put it short, and an absolute monster. And one day while Michelle was out looking for a job, she had actually asked her mom to watch baby Joey. And when Michelle came home, her mom was gone, and Joey was with Carlos, who was shit-faced and like slurring his words, stumbling around. So Michelle's like trying to find Joey, and she hears him calling out for her. And he was so scared, the boy had even wet himself. And at that point, Carlos had grabbed Joey from Michelle. She like picked him up and Carlos grabs Joey out of her hands and in one swift movement, fractures the little boy's knee.
Oh my God.
So Michelle immediately takes Joey to the hospital. And due to the circumstances of that whole environment, Joey was removed from her care as authorities figured that's not a safe place for him to live. And he went into foster care. And that part is heartbreaking because, one, remember I said Michelle just wanted to be the best mom she could be, and she was out trying to find a job, and this happens. It's like not even her fault. And two, because if this one singular event never happens, maybe Michelle doesn't end up crossing paths with the monster who we're about to meet.
Yeah, in her book, she goes into a lot of detail about this and about how they took Joey from her. And there's a passage where she talks about the abuse she had suffered her entire life, physical, sexual, etc. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how she lived under a bridge and was starving for days on end, and how she just went through all these horrible things. But she said that losing Joey was the most brutal thing she had experienced. Like, she was just completely shattered and heartbroken.
And doesn't that, like, really put things into perspective? Like, all of this torture she endured, just having her kid taken away, that was worse than all of that. So that should tell you how much he meant to her.
Wow.
So needless to say, Michelle was desperate to get her son back. And on August 23rd, 2002, she actually had an appointment with social services. And I had read different things that one, it was either an appointment with social services or was an actual court date, like a custody thing. So regardless, Michelle had been staying with her cousin at the time because she was trying to stay close to these social security offices. And she woke up that morning focused and determined and had a plan. She was going to get Joey back. And she left the house on foot. But in August, it's hot, it's humid. And she has no car, remember, no cell phone, just the belief that if she showed up and told the truth, that maybe she could bring Joey home. And Michelle kind of had a rough idea of the address of where this court date or this meeting was supposed to take place, but she soon realized that once she was out there, she couldn't find it. So she stopped at a store to use the payphone, trying to call the caseworker and be like, hey, this is what's going on. I'm going to be a little late. I'm just trying to find the place. Help me. But she couldn't get through to him.
Yeah. I can't imagine how desperate she had to have been at that point. Like, her future is pretty much riding on this appointment to make this meeting or court date. And the worst part is she actually had a ride lined up. It was figured out. It was confirmed. A family member was supposed to take her. And then, so the appointment that day was at 2:30 p.m. At 11 a.m. that morning, the family member called her and bailed.
Wow.
And remember, there was no Uber or Lyft back in 2002. And I don't know the taxi situation in Cleveland. I honestly have never been there. But still, she didn't have the funds to do that.
Yeah, how's she going to pay for it? So,
right.
And it's not like she can just jump in a car and GPS it, you know? So she literally has nothing. She even calls. So she calls the office and asks for help. And according to her book, the receptionist was rude to her and basically said, you should have taken the ride when we offered it to you. And before Michelle could explain that she had a ride, but they canceled, the woman hung up on her. So she's panicking and starting to look for alternative ways to get to this appointment. And she's at a Family Dollar store asking the cashier if they know the area, if they can help give her directions. And that's when a man in the store offers to help. And Michelle looks at the man and she's like, I know this guy. His name was Ariel Castro, and Michelle was friendly with his daughter, Emily. Michelle's cousin, Deanna, and Emily were friends from school, and the three would often hang out a lot. So this isn't a stranger. This is your friend's dad, you know? So it's somebody you would trust, someone you wouldn't think twice to ask for help. And Ariel told her, he's like, I know exactly where that place is. Hop in, I'll give you a ride. So, like, day is saved. But Ariel doesn't drive Michelle to her appointment. Instead, he takes her to his house at 2207 Seymour Avenue on the pretense of first picking up his daughter, but also showing Michelle a puppy that Ariel said might be an awesome surprise when she gets Joey back. Here's a puppy that you can give him. But the second they step foot in her house, Michelle realizes Ariel's daughter doesn't live with him, and there are no puppies.
Oh, all right. Two things. First of all, it's really terrifying that Castro was, like, almost prepared for this. Like,
isn't
he was out on
up?
The prowl. Yeah, it's like he was out on the prowl for his prey, and Michelle got caught in his web. And I feel like it could have literally been anyone. And I know all parts of this case are horrific, but, like, the fact that this monster uses his daughter to kidnap these women is so sick. This is a friend's father. She only got in the car because, like, she kind of knew him. She had seen pictures of him when Emily was on speakerphone with him. She had been in the room and said hello. And, you know, so this wasn't a stranger. And just to use your child is sick. It reminds me of Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, who would show his victims pictures of his son, Matthew. So they would be like, oh, this is a dad. He's a good dude.
A sympathy. Earn their trust.
It's beyond evil. And we know, I feel like, especially at that moment, Michelle was very vulnerable. And Castro clearly took advantage of that.
Perverts don't wear signs.
Mm-mm.
So 2207, let me tell you a little bit about this house. So it's a modest home, nothing out of the ordinary. It's kind of typical for the area. It was built around 1890 and remodeled in 1956, and the house had two stories. It was about 1,400 square feet with an unfinished basement. It's the kind of place that you would drive by and not even look at twice. It looks like every other house there. But inside, the horror began immediately. So once Castro got Michelle into the house, he tied her up, including tying a cord tightly around her neck, and he proceeded to masturbate on her. Ugh. And as he did this, he told her that she wouldn't be there long, that he was just lonely. So, I mean, as awful as that is, first of all, it's a lie. But second of all, Michelle had to be like, if I can just survive this moment, I can maybe get out of here. But that wasn't the case. So once he finished, he used the cords that were binding Michelle and he tied them to this long wire attached to the wall. And he also like bound her hands behind her back and her feet. It was almost like a hog tie position, but he then attached both sides to these two wires hanging off these poles and hung her like she was hung like a trophy fish. It was like a foot off the ground. And he took this dirty ass sock and he shoved it in her mouth and duct taped it around her head. And he goes, I'm going to get some food, and just leaves the room.
This is a literal nightmare. And the ejaculation on her and then the dirty, disgusting sock in her mouth. When I was reading about this part in her book, I was physically nauseous.
It's repulsive. And this is child's play, though, compared to what would happen to Michelle and eventually two other women over the next 11 years.
Jeez.
I'm getting so pissed off just talking about it, but Ariel Castro left Michelle hanging like that for more than 24 hours. Mm-hmm. With nothing to eat or drink, she was forced to urinate all over herself. And when he finally did return with some fast food, he attempted to force feed her. And when she refused, he got angry. So he carried her into a different room, threw her on this dirty mattress, and proceeded to rape Michelle over and over and over. And Michelle writes that the assaults were so violent, like this dirty mattress was covered in blood. And afterward, he whined to Michelle about how he had this bad childhood and how he was sexually assaulted. And he complained that his wife left him and he was so upset that he didn't mean to beat the hell out of her. Well, get Ariel. Well, then, okay. Then it's all right.
I know. Like, shut up, you disgusting monster. Like, I hate these little pity parties he throws himself. And I do want to note, I personally don't believe his stories of being sexually abused as a child. Like, though they were never confirmed, as far as I could find out, other than by him. And we know he's a psycho liar. So I think that these stories are questionable.
I completely agree. And I do know that later on, he admits that he was addicted to sex and pornography. So mm-hmm. I feel like that holds more weight than some sob story about his childhood. But regardless, when he was finished attacking Michelle and spewing all this emotional garbage, Castro stands up and he throws money at her like a prostitute. And he says it's payment for your services, which he would later, we're going to find out later in part two, that he does this to the other girls too. It's just weird.
Yeah, so weird.
But it's about to get weirder and a lot worse. At this point, Castro starts going through Michelle's purse and he comes across her ID. And on it, he sees that she's 21. Ariel assumed she was a younger teenager. So when he learned her real age, he became furious because, are you ready for this? This fucking predator was out looking for a child that day.
Oh, this infuriates me. Like, Castro should have been castrated.
It's beyond sick. And so after he calms down about this whole age thing, he tells her, we're going to be friends. And he puts his arm around Michelle and she pushes him away, which sends him into a blind rage. So he then grabs Michelle by the hair and drags her down in the basement where he ties her to a pole with heavy chains wrapped around her neck, her waist, and he binds her hands behind her back.
She talks about this in the book, and she talks about how she counted the number of times he wrapped these heavy, rusty chains around her. 5 times she was like, they were wrapped around her. And she talks about how disgusting this basement was. And Ed, you know, smells are a big trigger for me.
Yep.
She talked about how the basement smelled like mold and mildew, and Castro smelled worse. He always stunk.
There's something about those old unfinished basements. I have one in my rental property, and it has a smell, and it lends itself to creepiness. And mm-hmm. so it's like, it's just magnifying all of the awful things that are going on down there. So Castro tells Michelle that he needs to see if he can trust her. So while she's tied up, he basically shoves another dirty sock in her mouth to keep her quiet. And then he throws a motorcycle helmet over her head. And Michelle's struggling to breathe at this point and eventually passes out. And when she woke up, she had no idea how much time had passed. No clue. And in a panic, she begins to search for a way out. And she manages to pull her arms apart and kind of break the zip ties that had bound her hands. And in the darkness, she's fumbling around looking for something to help her escape from this situation. And as she struggled to kind of work the padlock on those heavy chains that were wrapped around her, she hears a noise. And it was Castro's car. He was coming home. And he basically comes in the house, down the basement steps, and discovers she had gotten out of the ties. And he was furious. Oof. He questions her about why she broke out of the chains. And as punishment for this attempted escape, you guessed it, more sexual abuse. And abuse, I should step back, because abuse isn't the word, it's torture. Mm-hmm. He basically holds a pipe over her head and tells her that if she screams, he would shove said pipe down her throat. And all she could do was kind of lay there and just plead to be released. And Melissa, I'm going to ask you to read this next part.
Yeah, this next part is rough. So in her book, Michelle doesn't even actually talk about the things he did to her that day. But in her book, Finding Me, she writes, quote, "What happened over the next 3 hours is still hard for me to think about. He didn't just rape me the way he had upstairs. He murdered my heart, or at least the small part that was still left after what I went through when I was a girl. He forced me to do things that are too painful for me to describe, things that I have never done and would never do again. I couldn't scream. I couldn't pray. I couldn't even ask God to help me get back to Joey. I was in so much shock and fear that all I could do was lie there like I was dead. In a way, I think a part of you has to die in order to go through a thing like that. It's the only way a person can survive it." End quote.
How freaking powerful and descriptive. And just, she said so much without describing what was going on. She said so much. So Michelle would spend the next couple days trapped in this disgusting basement. She lost track of time pretty much until she eventually became familiar with Castro's routine. So she could tell it was a weekday if he returned home in his work uniform. And I guess he had this band that would come over to rehearse on Saturday night. So she kind of figured out what day it was based on what was happening in the house. And Castro continued to violently abuse and assault Michelle, barely feeding her, never letting her bathe. And when he did decide to feed her, it was like rotten food or leftovers. He would tell her that he needed to trust her before she could move upstairs into the main house. And she would stay in this disgusting, moldy, mildewy basement for months. Ugh. And every night he would rape, abuse, and torture Michelle for hours on end. And Castro promised to let her go once he brought other girls there. Like, can you imagine hearing that? Like, he had a plan.
So, I know. Ugh.
Michelle begs him to not bring anyone else into this nightmare. And for the following 11 years, Michelle Knight would be confined to this house, just concealed in plain sight.
And the worst part is that there's no one out there looking for her.
No, her disappearance was not treated as an emergency. She was 21, so she was legally an adult. Her mother had filed a missing persons report, but like not much was done to find her. She was this forgotten soul. There was no investigation. They knew her. She wasn't a rich white kid, to be very blunt about it. You know, there was no reason to go looking for her. There were no news alerts. There were no posters. There was no press coverage. It was as if she just vanished into thin air and no one cared. And we've seen this so many times that to the system, she was just easy to overlook. And Ariel Castro knew that after 5 seconds of talking to her. And one other little nugget from Michelle's book that I want to share is kind of an offhand comment that Castro made one day regarding JonBenet Ramsey. And it's completely weird and off topic, but he said to Michelle, quote, "I wish I would have gotten to that little girl first. If some other bastard didn't get to her first, that could have been me." End quote. What?
Oh, like, that's foul.
She mentions that after hearing that, she wanted to punch him in the teeth, which with good reason.
For real.
Sick, sick man.
Disgusting.
So before we get into these other two women, well, they were minors. So before we get into these two children that he abducted, I think we need to talk a little bit about who Ariel Castro was.
How about we do anything but that?
Remember, this is a story about hope and courage. And I just want you to know a little bit about what shaped this guy into the cold-blooded monster that he became.
Yeah.
So Ariel Castro was born in a small town of about 1,000 in Puerto Rico. I was going to say the name was like Yuko or Yuka. I can't pronounce the name. But
yeah.
He was born on July 10th, 1960 to parents Pedro Castro and Lillian Rodriguez. So, hey, his birthday was just a few days ago. So happy birthday, shitbag.
Hope you're enjoying it in hell.
Jesus Christ. His parents were never legally married and they separated when he was a child. And they actually moved to Pennsylvania to Reading, which is right down the street from us, man. And
scary.
He eventually then moved from Reading, his family, over to Cleveland, where Castro's father and other relatives were living. And he had three main siblings, but in the end, we've heard stories about him having nine siblings. And I think this was a combination of him having three biological siblings, but then once his family moved and some cousins, and they learned that he had some half brothers too. So I think in all, it was roughly nine full and half siblings. And fun fact, according to Cleveland.com, his family was one of the first Hispanic families to settle in Cleveland from Puerto Rico after World War II. So
wow.
It's a shame because they put themselves on the map and then something like this happens. So as we touched on, Castro claims that he was sexually and physically abused throughout his childhood, and there are reports that he was raped by an uncle. But according to his competency evaluation, which comes out in this court psychiatric clinic later on, he claims that he was assaulted by a neighborhood boy who was 9 years old when he was five, and that his mother had physically abused him by striking him with belts, sticks, and an open hand daily, in addition to verbal assaults. Doesn't feel so nice, does it?
Seriously.
So I don't know what kind of student Ariel was, but according to this competency report, he was suspended in junior high for touching a girl's breast. And obviously, that's a big deal, but especially in junior high, but it just goes to show that his sexual issues started at a very early age. So as an adult, Castro meets his girlfriend, Grimelda Figueroa, when his family moved into a house across the street from hers in the 1980s. And Castro and Grimelda lived with both sets of their parents until they moved into their own home at 2207 Seymour Ave in 1992. And according to Grimelda's sister, Alida, yeah, all hell started breaking loose after the couple moved into this new house. Family members claimed that Castro would violently beat Grimelda, breaking her nose, her ribs, her arms. He caused a blood clot in her brain that resulted in an inoperable tumor. And he also at one point threw Grimelda down a flight of stairs, cracking her skull. And in 1993, Castro was arrested for domestic violence, but was not indicted by a grand jury. So they must have not have found enough evidence, or something happened. She recanted or something. After another alleged beating in 1996, Grimelda moved out of the house and took custody of their four children. And police actually assisted her in this move just to keep her safe from Castro. They detained him, but they didn't press any charges. And Castro continued to threaten and attack Grimelda even after she left. In 2005, she filed charges with the Cuyahoga County Domestic Relations Court, which accused Castro of inflicting multiple severe injuries and frequently abducting their daughters. And the court granted her a temporary restraining order, but it was dismissed a few months later. And sadly, Grimelda passed away in 2012 due to that brain tumor.
So Castro basically murdered her, is like what you're saying, because he caused that tumor, and then that's how she passed away.
And I was about to say indirectly, but no, directly.
Directly, yeah.
So, and in case all of this isn't disturbing enough, I should mention that Castro worked as a bus driver for the Cleveland Metro School District until November of 2012, when he was terminated for, quote, bad judgment. And this included making an illegal U-turn with infants and toddlers on the bus, using his bus to go grocery shopping, leaving children on the bus while he got Wendy's, and, leaving the bus unattended while he went home to take a nap.
Apparently, when he went to Wendy's, he told the kid to, quote, lay down, bitch. Like, that's, why?
I don't have words.
It's just like last week where it's so scary that Ian was able to work at that school. It's terrifying that this job is giving Castro access to neighborhoods and to children. And you have to have some sort of trust in your bus driver or your child's bus driver to put your child on said bus. And the worst part about everything is he looked like anyone else, albeit hideously ugly, but he looked like a normal human being. And like his house, if you were to walk past it, it looked like anybody else's on the block.
Exactly right. But inside, those windows were boarded up. There were, the doors had multiple locks on them. There were rooms rigged with chains and ropes and padlocks. I mean, it was a house of horrors.
And all the while, like, the world is still going on outside of this house, completely unaware what Michelle and the other two girls are later going through.
No idea.
I wonder how long he had been doing this and if he had had other victims prior to Michelle.
I find it hard to believe that this would have been his first. I feel like you don't go from 0 to 100 by, like, abducting girls and keeping them chained up in your house. Like, there's got to be an in-between.
I completely agree. Oh, we talked earlier about his daughter, Emily, who was, like, kind of friends with Michelle Knight. And then you said with Grimilda, he had 4 kids.
Yeah, he did. I think it was 3 daughters and a son. And it was after that beating in 96 when the custody was given over to Grimilda. So thankfully, they didn't live with him at the time. Mm-hmm. Because if they did, God knows what he would have been doing to them, too. Oof. But on the flip side, I'd considered this. On the flip side, if his daughters were there, the other girls wouldn't have been, I think. So I don't know. Again, it's just this weird, all these circumstances that have to come together. So one of his daughters, Arlene, was actually a good friend of Gina DeJesus, who I know her name doesn't make sense yet, but you're going to meet her in a minute. And Arlene describes her relationship with Ariel Castro as not particularly close, but says her father never abused him. Castro's son, though, Anthony, alleges that his father did abuse him and definitely favored the sisters over the boys. And Anthony believes Castro abused him because he would try to protect his mother. And in a horrifying twist, I don't know if you knew this or not, Emily Castro, she's currently serving a 25-year prison sentence for slashing her 11-month-old infant daughter's throat while she was 19 years old and also trying to kill herself, all because she had a boyfriend that moved out of the home. So clearly the apple doesn't fall far from the psychopath tree.
I didn't know that. It's awful. We've talked about this before, but it's sickening to think about how deep this damage can go, like how trauma, mental illness, and violence can just echo across generations. It's like a cycle and it just doesn't stop. And
no,
it makes you wonder how many warning signs were ignored and like how many chances there were to stop this.
Yeah, you hear it all the time. Break the cycle. When these families are in these situations, all it takes is one person to do the right thing and it can break the cycle.
Yeah.
But back to Michelle and 2207 Seymour. So during her first year of captivity, Michelle endured not just physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, but psychological torture. So eventually, Castro does bring Michelle upstairs into a small bedroom with this filthy mattress on the floor. There's no windows, no light. She's got chains on her wrists and ankles, and she's starved until her body begins to shut down. And Castro would take her clothing and once made her stay naked for 4 months. He threatened her constantly with death and with lies about her son, with cruelty so specific, it's hard to repeat. He would occasionally show some semblance of humanity because he brought her a radio one day and then a TV, but he would also play these little mind games like we talked about earlier. He would leave certain doors unlocked, basically daring her to try to escape because it was more of a test to see if she'd actually do it. He would tell her no one cared, no one's looking for you, that she was forgotten. And for a long time, he was right, because Michelle, no one was looking for her. And people would come out later and say, yeah, we were so concerned, but it's all a bunch of like just damage control at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Despite all of this, Michelle refused to let Ariel Castro break her spirit. She created these little routines. She would make up songs in her head. She would look at birds and rainbows out the window just to find some kind of peaceful imagery. And she would picture little Joey's face, his laugh, his little hands, you know? And she was just picturing the life that she wanted to live with Joey. And that was like driving her to survive this nightmare. But there were times that hope was almost impossible when she was chained so tightly that she couldn't even stand upright. And get ready for this. So she became pregnant 5 times. And Castro forcibly caused her to miscarry each time. And I say forcibly because he would starve her. He would push her down the stairs, and at one time he even took a dumbbell, a weight, and just right in the stomach.
Yeah, she goes into a lot of detail about these forced miscarriages, really forced abortions.
Yeah.
How they happened and what happened afterwards, and it's really hard to read. It's devastating. And what's even more horrific, like even though Castro was literally the one who beat the fetus out of her, when the remains left her body, he would beat her for aborting his child. What does that, what?
Right? Well, that should tell, that right there should tell you everything you need to know about this guy. And ready for this? So the violence that Michelle endured would leave her unable to ever again have biological children of her own.
Oh.
When he wasn't starving her, Michelle was being given one meal a day, usually something spoiled again. And Michelle went years without seeing another human being except for her captor. And somehow she held on.
That is a strength that most of us can't even imagine. I hope never have to live through or imagine. And like, it's like even in complete darkness, she found ways to protect her mind and spirit. And you brought it up at the beginning that if possibly if she didn't have the early life that she did, I don't know that she would have made it through this.
I think she just like refused to forget who she was. Like even when Castro tried to rewrite her story every single day. But by 2003, Michelle would learn that Castro had no intentions of making her the only guest in this house of horrors. So I wanted to introduce you to Amanda Marie Berry. And Amanda was born on April 22nd, 1986 and went missing on April 21st, 2003. So if you do that math, one day short of her 17th birthday.
Wow.
And Amanda was last heard from around 8 p.m. that night when she called her sister to tell her that she was walking home from her job at a local Burger King. It was at the corner of Lorraine Avenue and West 110th Street. And she wasn't seen again for another decade.
I remember reading somewhere that Amanda had seriously considered calling out of work that day. Like she was
I saw that. My
birthday's tomorrow. I really don't feel like going in, but she wanted to do the right thing by honoring the commitment she made to work that shift.
Absolutely.
Think about if she had called out. So things could be wildly different. Would be wildly different.
Definitely. But I'm also not convinced that he wouldn't have just chosen some other poor innocent girl, you know?
I'm sure he would have, yeah.
Yes. So the FBI initially considered Amanda a runaway until about a week after her disappearance when an unidentified male used her cell phone to call her mother, Luana Miller. And the caller said, "I have Amanda. She's fine and will be coming home in a couple days," before hanging up. But just that phone call alone is creepy. And
so
newsflash,
scary.
Amanda didn't come home. And it got to the point where Luana was so desperate for answers that she went on the Oprah Winfrey Show and Montel Williams, where self-proclaimed psychic Sylvia Brown told her that her daughter was dead and that she was, quote, in water. And this obviously devastated Luana, causing her to take down pictures of Amanda and give away her stuff. Like she gave away her computer because she's like, she's not coming home at this point. She took Sylvia's premonition to heart. Yes. So Luana did continue to search for Amanda before she died from heart failure in March of 2006. And can you imagine having to go through the life not knowing what happened to your daughter? And unfortunately, this is stuff that we see all the time with these families that these stories are about. They go years sometimes. These cold cases that drag on 20, 30, 40 years, they just don't, imagine not knowing. I pray that it's something that none of us or any of my loved ones will ever have to go through because I see the damage it causes. But all this time, and despite Sylvia Brown's great mythical prediction, Amanda wasn't dead at all. She'd been kidnapped by Ariel Castro during that walk home from Burger King and taken to 2207 Seymour Ave. And similar to Michelle, Castro used Amanda's friendship with one of his daughters to convince her to get in the car.
I feel like her mom died of a broken heart. And I saw that other family members also said that. And clearly the blame here falls on Ariel Castro, but shame on Sylvia Brown for being so cruel to a mother experiencing the worst possible situation.
Yeah. Well, you know my feelings on psychics, except for Psychic Monica. That woman's a damn
prophet. You love
her. Well, Castro would keep Amanda and Michelle separated. They wouldn't see each other for months, and even when they did see each other, it was just for a second. It was like a long enough to say hello and meet each other's like fearful gaze. And Michelle knew when Castro was raping Amanda, as he would turn on this loud salsa music to kind of drown out the screams. And occasionally when Michelle would see news about Amanda's disappearance on the television, she would crank it up as loud as possible. She wanted like Amanda to know that people were looking for her and people cared about her and that people loved her. But Castro would, of course, use this to psychologically torture Michelle. He would point to the news broadcast and be like, "Look, everyone's looking for Amanda. Nobody's looking for you." Like,
sick.
It's sick. So So this house was now a dungeon with multiple captives, each one enduring their own nightmares. But we're going to fast forward one more year, almost like clockwork. And this part is very weird. Like the timings of how he abducted these women is curious to me, but we can talk about that in part two, because we still have one more person to meet. Georgina Lynn DeJesus, who went by Gina. She was born on February 13th, 1990, and had gone missing on April 2nd, 2004, when she was just 14 years old. And Gina was last seen using a payphone around 3 o'clock in the afternoon while on her way home from a middle school at West 105th Street and Lorraine Avenue. And if you recall, Amanda was kidnapped from 110th and Lorraine, so just 5 blocks away.
Wow. This guy was literally like operating in his own backyard.
This reminded me, I produced an episode one time. Do you know who the Grim Sleeper is?
Yeah, Lonnie Franklin.
So Lonnie Franklin was a garbage truck. He was a sanitation worker, and he lived right in the area where you could see the route where his trash truck would go. He lived right in the middle. So working for the city, he knew the alleys, he knew the streets. And this just reminds me so much of this guy. He would just be a predator in his own backyard because he knew it.
I kept thinking of the other Cleveland monster, Anthony Sowell. I think that's how you say his last name.
Yeah.
I forget what his media tagline murder name was, but because some of that was happening during this. Like, he got caught, I think, in 2010, and we'll talk about that more in part two.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you remember me mentioning, Gina was actually friends with Castro's daughter, Arlene. And shortly before Gina disappeared, she and Arlene had called Arlene's mother, Grimelda Figueroa, for permission to have a sleepover at DeJesus' home. But Figueroa replied they couldn't, and the two girls parted ways, which meant Arlene was one of the last people to see Gina before her disappearance.
So crazy.
Oh, my gosh. And once Gina walked off on her own, a car pulled up next to her. It was Ariel Castro. And she was friends with Arlene. I mean, you know, she knew him. It was a familiar face. And he asked Gina if she had seen Arlene, to which Gina replied, no, we just parted ways. And Ariel said, he's like, I've been driving around looking for her, and could you help me search for her? And of course, Gina agrees. It was her friend's dad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No one witnessed her abduction, and an Amber Alert was not issued, which angered her father to no end. He said in 2006, quote, the Amber Alert should work for any missing child, whether it's an abduction or a runaway, a child needs to be found, end quote.
Yeah.
And Gina's mother was immediately worried about her daughter because she didn't come home at a regular time. And according to sources, Gina was a little developmentally delayed, mentally more like a 9 or 10-year-old, more than a 14-year-old. So her mother worried that her naivety kind of led to her being easily manipulated or something worse. And after disappearing, Gina DeJesus was featured on America's Most Wanted when a segment aired basically connecting her disappearance to Amanda Berry's. And the disappearance received regular media attention up until 2012, while the families held public vigils and people started to care once a third person went missing. Mm-hmm. Then it became a bigger deal. Get this. Not only did Castro attend at least two of these vigils, he admitted to Michelle that he had joined the search parties looking for Gina.
You know he got off on that, though. Like, he's a monster.
100% he did. But it gets worse because he was friends with Gina's dad. Like, they had known each other since their school days. And that's how hellbent Castro was on living out this selfish, sadistic fantasy. He kidnapped his good friend's daughter.
It's beyond a lot of the stuff we've covered. Like, this is a brutal case, and he is a horrific individual.
Understatement. So at this point now, we have 3 girls / women in captivity in Ariel's home on Seymour Avenue. And the dynamic is about to change in the worst way imaginable. And unfortunately, to find out what happens, you're going to need to wait for part two. I will say that, unfortunately, that next week isn't going to be much better in regards to the atrocities that we're going to discuss. However, I said it earlier, this is a story of hope and resilience and survival. So I promise you, if you hang in there through all this stuff, there is a happy ending.
Yeah, in addition to this being a long case, and that's why we split it in two, we also felt like this was a really big downer, and all of it at once was a lot to handle, to take in and absorb. So, yes, we will be back next week with the conclusion. Don't miss that. And just so you don't miss it, make sure you like, like, subscribe, and follow. I went through all of our information at the beginning, but we are Murder Unscripted or murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. So hit us up. Tell us how you're feeling about this episode. You're probably feeling awful, because so are we.
Yeah, this is terrible.
This is. It really is. I'm ready to go downstairs and watch Big Bang Theory or something.
Something mindless. I do that too. After we're done with these things, I watch like people falling, people slipping on ice. Like I need to see something just...
Yeah, either Big Bang or The Office, one or the other.
Do you know, people ask me all the time about the new, have you seen the new true crime thing? It's like, no, I have not, because I can't do it anymore. Like, I'll purposely watch something that doesn't make me think. Like, I want to watch trash television.
I concur. Well, on that note, until next week, be safe, be kind, and seriously, if this story taught you nothing else, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
No, they do not. And there is no room for jokes here. This is
no. The
epitome of a pervert.
Yuck. Bye.